Welcome to 2021, Volume 3, Issue 1, Summer Podcast Edition, Part 2, of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion, published June 15, 2025. All contents are protected under the Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives, 4.0 International Deed. For figures, citations, notes, and references, please refer to the printed articles at www.jpeonline.org. Part 2. Table of Contents. LaGuardia Lobianco, Alicia. 2021. Emotions Under Trauma. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 3, Number 1, 31-38. https://doi.org/10-33497/2021-summer.6/Mindaka Dina. 2021. Seeing Complexity to Continue to Better Understand Emotions. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 3, Number 1, 39-48. https://doi.org/10-33497/2021-summer.7. Brady, Michael. 2021. Replies to Benzeyev, Starkey, Reyes Cardenas, Bloomfield, LaGuardia Lobianco, and Mendoza. Journal of Philosophy of Emotion 3, Number 1. 49-61. https://doi.org/10-33497/2021-summer.8. Article 6. Emotions Under Trauma. By Alicia LaGuardia Lobianco. Michael Brady, 2019, has written a clear and informative work on the role of emotions in our lives. He argues that emotion, in addition to reason, is an integral part of what makes us human. Without our capacities to love, anger, fear, and be curious, the meaning in our lives would be impoverished. Brady pays close attention to the complex reality of human emotions, carefully noting that the epistemic, motivational, and social values of emotions are contingent. Emotions can misfire, misdirect, and bias as much as they can illuminate and inform, but Brady argues that these dangers, though present, do not undercut the value of emotions. Rather, he pushes us to shift our focus to consider these values, though without ignoring the potential pitfalls. This attention to detail is a virtue of Brady's analysis, especially given the decidedly grounded topic of emotions with its decidedly untidy subjects in human agents. Yet for all these attentive virtues, his analysis assumes a certain sort of life, that which is shaped by the usual upsets and successes, griefs and loves, a certain sort of world, that which is safe, trustworthy, and ready to reveal its information, and a certain sort of agent, one who is oriented to this world as an eager discoverer and willing social participant. And while this portrait of a life, world, and agent that neatly fit together is true of many people, and the corresponding analysis of emotions therefore appropriate in these cases, its privileging of certain ways of being in the world circumscribes the theory to ideal agents and circumstances. This is worrisome if we think the philosophy of emotions, perhaps more so than some other subfields of philosophy, should capture and explain human experiences as they are actually lived, and should do so because, as Brady effectively argues, emotions are a central part of human existence. If a theory of emotions purports to give us some insight into our lives, then it would behoove us to consider emotions in real, messy, tragic, imperfect, self-destructive, and uncertain lives, not just those lives in which all the pieces seem to fit into place. My criticism of Brady's work is thus not with the mechanics of his theory or his normative conclusions about emotions, which I largely agree with, nor is my aim to nitpick his cases with counterexamples. Rather, I'm concerned with the implicit assumptions in his approach and the incomplete view of emotions they yield. I will try to make this case by focusing on the function, dysfunction, and value of emotions in one all too common but non-ideal condition: traumatic experiences and their fallout. Suffering real or threatened harm, especially, though not exclusively, from other agents, in the form of acute attacks or prolonged abusive treatment, Herman 1992-1997, can deeply shape an agent's emotional orientation to the world as well as what information is salient to her, what she values, and what motivates her. And it does so by design. The characteristic emotional responses to trauma are not deviant in one important sense. Hypervigilance, fear, distrust in others, quickness to anger, for instance, are adaptive responses to a real threat or attack, though paradoxically, it is just these emotional responses that are also destructive. Under trauma, the world has lashed out and caused damage, and the agent has responded appropriately. Therefore, I think we should resist a temptation to dismiss cases of trauma as pathological outliers. Rather, we should understand traumatic responses as another way of being in the world, a painful, difficult way of being that requires address, but nonetheless a legitimate and valid way that an agent makes sense of her life and relates to the world. And this means we should take seriously the way that trauma changes the landscape of emotions for these agents. In what follows, I'll apply parts of Brady's analysis of the value of emotions to traumatic experiences and try to show how this both interrupts and expands his view. I'll argue that looking at how trauma shapes the emotional profile of survivors complicates the role of emotions in our lives, not only by providing additional ways to understand the value of emotions, but also by suggesting that we have to look at an agent's circumstances, especially adverse, non-ideal circumstances, in order to articulate the function and potential values of certain emotions. I'll focus on two parts of Brady's analysis: the epistemic value of emotions as motivation to seek reasons, and the role of emotions in cultivating intellectual virtues. I aim not to undermine Brady's view, but instead to tell a more complicated story about the role of emotions in our lives. Emotions and motivation. Brady argues that emotions have practical value as motivational forces. When we feel remorse, it motivates us to redress our wrongs. When we feel anger at injustice, we are moved to intervene or resist, Brady 2019, pages 94 to 98. We are pulled to action in order to escape the negative feeling of these emotions and to enjoy its relief, and emotions are often more powerful in this capacity than an inert rational judgment. Brady writes that these emotions seem vital in the lives of creatures like us. Those who are unable to feel emotions like remorse and guilt and shame will find it very difficult to live and function and flourish in normal human society, 2019, page 97. He goes on to consider how one would try to go through the motions of an apology without remorse, and how ineffective this would be. So, a lack of these emotions would be a significant loss. By a similar token, certain emotions have an epistemic value in motivating the search for reasons. Brady argues that they do this by virtue of attentional persistence. We tend to remain fixed on our guilt, shame, or jealousy, no matter how hard we try to shake it, 2019, page 58. And this attention can motivate reflection on the objects of our emotions, thereby enabling us to discover reasons which bear on the accuracy of our initial emotional appraisals. In other words, emotions can motivate the search for and discovery of reasons, and in so doing can help to bring about a more accurate judgment as to whether emotional appearance matches evaluative reality, Brady 2019, page 58. So one's nagging fear of house spiders can lead one to investigate the reason for this fear, and to realize there is nothing, in fact, dangerous about these spiders. One's initial appraisal was incorrect. Though I'm sympathetic to this analysis, I'm worried that it privileges a world and an agent that are undistorted by traumatic settings. Under trauma, emotions can give survivors exactly the wrong information, information that reinforces a traumatic response, and crucially, they do so by that very function which, under normal circumstances, facilitates knowledge. Consider the typical emotional profile of someone who is coping with a traumatic event, for instance, someone living under abusive conditions. A characteristic symptom of abusive victimization is feelings of guilt and self-blame for that abuse. Survivors adapt to a distorted moral environment in which they are told they are the cause of the abuse they suffer. The abuser's word is God and thus cannot be wrong. To make sense of the abuse, survivors often resort to confabulation, convinced that they must have done something wrong, Speer 2020. And all this can very clearly lead to strong, pervasive feelings of guilt and self-blame that are utterly unwarranted. The issue here is not that emotions can misfire and sometimes give us the wrong information, as Brady acknowledges. Rather, the issue is that part of the systematic harm of relational violence is that it distorts part of a survivor's emotional system so that it no longer functions as it should. Certain emotions can no longer reliably give correct knowledge in certain areas. Emotional sensors have been damaged by abuse and weaponized against the survivor. I think this idea actually supports Brady's argument for the value of emotions. Like a neuroscientist who discovers the function of some part of the brain by noting what ability is lost when it is damaged, recognizing how adverse conditions systematically distort the function of emotions puts the value of emotions under healthy conditions into relief. Seeing how emotions go wrong reinforces their importance when they go right. But this picture is even more complicated. The distortion of emotions under trauma reinforces the value of these emotions in ideal conditions, but it also shows how the typical functioning of emotions can make things worse under traumatic conditions. Note that guilt and self-blame are emotions that can assist a survivor in coping with helplessness. If the survivor were responsible for their trauma, then they are not a mere victim of their abuser, or the abuser is not actually as terrible as the abuse suggests. But also note that it is exactly this rationalization, this search for reasons that explain existing guilt and self-blame, that the persistence of these emotions can motivate. Recall Brady's argument that emotions can motivate us to uncover the reasons for these emotions, like a question that must be answered. But when one lives in an environment in which negative self-regarding emotions like guilt and self-blame are induced and reinforced without justification, this motivational tendency of emotions can be a curse. If pervasive guilt motivates a survivor to figure out why they feel so guilty, the most likely available answer, and the one that is confirmed by the environment and other beliefs created by abuse, is that they have in fact done something wrong that warrants this guilt. This is at best a distortion and at worst a confabulation, but it reinforces just the moral inversion of right and wrong and the undermining of self-knowledge that helps keep the abuser in power. When the real reasons for one's emotions are hidden behind layers of psychological abuse, the motivation to explain these emotions can end up reinforcing patterns of abusive thinking. What is of value under healthy conditions is a disvalue under traumatic ones. Intellectual virtues under trauma. Brady articulates another important value of emotions. Certain emotions can lead to the development and regulation of intellectual virtues. Among the list of these excellences of knowing are open-mindedness, fair-mindedness, conscientiousness, intellectual courage, and intellectual humility. Certain emotions can constitute the motivational components of intellectual virtues. Brady 2019, page 64. Brady's paradigm example is curiosity. A disposition towards curiosity can lead us to seek out novel and interesting information. In other words, curiosity can motivate open-mindedness and motivate it better than the judgment that some bit of information is worthwhile. Again, I want to suggest that these virtues presume a safe environment and untraumatized agent, and that the landscape of intellectual virtues changes under trauma. In order to do this, I will use Lisa Tessman's 2005 Framework of Burden Virtues. In the conclusion of her book, Burden Virtues, Virtue Ethics for Liberatory Struggles, Tessman categorizes different types of what she calls burden virtues, that is, a trait exhibited under non-ideal adverse conditions which carries a cost, but can still be praiseworthy, 2005, page 167. The first type is a virtue that would be straightforwardly conducive to flourishing under ideal conditions, but which becomes taxing under non-ideal conditions. It allows the bearer to act as well as they can under actual conditions, but not without attendant remorse or regret, Tessman 2005, page 163. Call this type 1 burden virtue. A second type of burden virtue is only tenuously labeled a virtue by Tessman. This is a trait that allows for the best kind of life possible under adverse conditions, though this life is not a flourishing one, call this type 2 burden virtue. Though Tessman focuses on moral virtues and oppression, I propose to look at intellectual virtues under trauma as burden virtues, those traits which either facilitate survival under trauma yet carry an intellectual cost, or else run counter to intellectual flourishing for the price of survival. To return to the example of the abuse survivor, consider the fact that in order to get by in their environment, a survivor must be acutely aware of any indicators that the abuser can become angry or violent so as to preclude them if possible, insofar as they are predictable. The survivor must stick to the script they are given, pay attention to the abuser's moods and desires, and do their best not to upset anything. Hypervigilance and attention to detail can help the survivor quickly attend to those unpredictable triggers of abuse. Of course, this is part of the moral distortion of the environment, but it also means that for the sake of survival, curiosity is an incredible risk. Being disinclined to seek out novel information, remaining focused on the banal details of the abuser's preferences, is far safer than following the motivation to uncover an interesting truth. And this suggests that curiosity, and the open-mindedness it encourages, is maladaptive for the survivor. In these circumstances, closed-mindedness is a type 2 burdened intellectual virtue. It allows the survivor to navigate their situation as well as they can, but this hardly constitutes a flourishing life, intellectually and otherwise. Likewise, intellectual humility, another virtue, is a type 1 burden virtue under conditions of trauma. Under normal conditions, intellectual humility helps correct a tendency to bias our own knowledge and assume we are correct without much evidence. Under trauma, intellectual humility is an exacerbation of a disturbing tendency to undermine one's own knowledge, doubt one's own beliefs and intuitions, and discredit one's own voice, exactly those features of gaslighting that help constitute abuse, Abramson 2014. So, a tendency towards humility that straightforwardly contributes to intellectual flourishing under normal conditions here carries a significant cost. Instead, intellectual hubris, a tendency to trust your knowledge despite the evidence, seems to be a type 2 burdened intellectual virtue under trauma. It is only virtuous under certain non-ideal conditions. Brady offers a second way that emotions can help cultivate intellectual virtues. This is through regulatory virtues, 2019, page 67. Those virtues that help keep one's emotions in line with and properly motivating worthwhile intellectual goals. The prime example of this is intellectual wisdom, which helps keep in check and properly direct emotions that contribute to intellectual virtues. So, the intellectually wise person knows which topics and subjects and questions merit investigation, inquiry, and understanding, and is someone whose epistemic emotions are guided and regulated by this kind of evaluative knowledge. The wise person also knows when to stop inquiring and investigating. She knows when the level of knowledge and understanding she has attained is enough, relative to the topic or question at hand. Brady 2019, page 67 to 68. Intellectual wisdom thus helps one be more intellectually virtuous overall. Now, consider the regulatory virtue of intellectual wisdom for a trauma survivor. They will know which minutiae to inquire into when attempting to set up a predictable environment, when to stop investigating their abuser's actions, when to defer to their abuser against their own self-knowledge, when safety demands a retreat into self-doubt. An intellectually wise trauma survivor will have ample tools to negotiate their surroundings as well as they can, yet this hardly constitutes an intellectually flourishing life and, crucially, it makes them a less intellectually virtuous agent overall, understood in terms of non-adverse conditions. For outside these constrained circumstances, the survivor is cultivating a host of intellectual vices, which, indeed, is another way to understand type 2 burden virtues. These would be straightforward vices under ideal conditions. For a trauma survivor, having intellectual virtues, understood under ideal conditions, is risky, as these virtues can potentially run counter to the aims of survival. And while this does not mean the agent who is merely surviving is flourishing, it does mean that under conditions of trauma, the emotions that facilitate the development of intellectual virtues, and the virtues themselves, are actually maladaptive, and thus may make one's life go less well in the immediate circumstance. All this suggests, perhaps controversially, that we can't ignore or take for granted an agent's circumstances when thinking about virtue. Rather, the conditions of the world an agent lives in, ideal or otherwise, must be considered before we can determine which traits are virtuous for that agent. Conclusion. Though I've focused on trauma and interpersonal abuse here, these are not the only adverse conditions that can change the value of emotions, and for which intellectual virtues come out differently. Oppression, Tessman's focus, is another paradigm case. Since oppressed agents are often safer when intellectually deferring to privileged authorities, or at least incur a cost for failing to defer, for one instance. And this suggests that to fully articulate the roles and values of emotions and their connections to intellectual virtue in our human lives, we should pay close attention to the type of environment an agent is in and how she has learned to respond to that environment, and then investigate her emotions. I hope to have contributed to this goal by augmenting Brady's analysis, even in a small way. Article 7. Seeing Complexity to Continue to Better Understand Emotions. By Dina Mendonça. Michael S. Brady's book, Emotion, The Basics, 2019, provides an overview of the field of philosophy of emotions while raising awareness about the intrinsic complexity of the issues in emotion research. One of the illuminating conclusions of the book is pointing out how emotions provide the solution to an emotional problem, Brady 2019, page 54. Showing that any conception of emotion, in any theoretical framework, is itself the test to its overall proposal. That is, whatever conception of emotion is presented, it must be able to critically justify its own theory and at the same time solve specific problems of emotion theory. For example, arguing for a conception of emotion which has various distinctive elements that work together and enable emotions to do a variety of things provides a more adequate interpretation of how a great variety of emotional processes occur. Brady 2019, pages 9, 40, 89, 108, 152. Accordingly, Brady's proposal solves the problem of emotion's ambiguous epistemic role, Brady 2019, 40, because it explains that emotions can motivate the search for and discovery of reasons, and in so doing can help to bring about a more accurate judgment as to whether emotional appearance matches evaluative reality, Brady 2019, page 58. This is what ultimately explains how to overcome the apparent contradiction of emotion's epistemological role of being sometimes the source of bias, and at other times the guarantee of certainty, Goldie 2004, page 249, by showing that emotions are linked to attention and salience, and this is also what guides people to search for reasons that confirm or deny emotional information. Thus, the book highlights how emotion research is inevitably tied to specific philosophical assumptions, offering an important theoretical demand to evaluate emotion research by examining specific underlying philosophical assumptions. In order to unfold this theoretical richness of the book, three issues will serve as examples. First, how the interdependence between philosophical reflection and empirical evidence hides the more complex issue of which picture of the mind underlies different efforts in emotion research. Second, how examples of emotions given in the literature are tied to specific theoretical frameworks that reinforce specific conceptual interconnections at the cost of others. And finally, how pain provides a rich gateway to further reflect on the insightful topic on how emotions are connected to sensations, Bodis and Smith 2020, the underlying conception of the mind. Concerning the first issue, the philosophical discussion is inevitably linked to the vast empirical literature on emotion that has continuously increased since it began in experimental psychology, Gendron and Barrett 2009, and later taken up by neuroscientists like Antonio Damasio 1994, Joseph Ledoux 1998, and Jake Panksepp 1998. There is a sense in which philosophers are always hoping that their speculations are proven right by empirical research, as a decisive way to overcome the philosophical disagreements and debates. However, the empirical evidence does not guarantee a sure victory to any theoretical proposal, and often does not do much more than to help divide the field. This was already identified in the 1980s by Amélie Oxenberg-Rorty in her paper, From Passions to Emotions and Sentiments, Rorty 1982, page 172, and remains true nowadays. The reason for this state of affairs lies in how it is not always clear what the arbitrating theory neutral facts could be. When read fully and sympathetically, each robust theory comes complete with its own sustaining facts, Rorty 1982, page 172. This means that the disputes between the different theories end up being tied to how the phenomenon is initially described. No doubt, this is in part due to how no theory is able to capture the whole domain of the nature of emotions, and as Brady argues, the only viable way out for this lack of completeness is to accept that each different theory will capture a certain range of emotions, and is correct only in light of a specific limited domain of emotion experience, Brady, 2019, pages 35 to 36. However, there is another aspect of this theoretical obstacle, namely that the conceptual take on emotions is given by a certain conceptual topology within the mind. That is, part of the reason why there are several different theories of emotions is tied to the way there are different pictures of how they are conceived in the mind and in relation to the self, Rorty 1982, page 161. Amélie Rorty explains how the conception of the mind and that of the emotions changed during the period from Descartes to Rousseau. She describes that the standard procedure of philosophers in giving an account of the mind often began by critically exposing the work of their predecessor as something of a disaster of a technical nature, Rorty 1982, page 160, which then created the space to give their own proposed version. Often, these philosophers, such as Descartes and Hume, subsequently proceeded to explain emotional processes. They had to revise their initial accounts of the mind and its powers, Rorty 1982, page 161. According to Rorty, in this historical process, emotions stopped being only brute forces from physical states that needed to be controlled or suppressed, and became also a constitutive part of human beings. After this transformation, emotions are no longer just disruptions, but, instead, also count as motives for actions and guides for morality. Of course, this is just a small part of how the concept of emotion makes for a long and complicated history, Scarantino and D'Souza 2021, page 6, and Rorty's diagnosis is an historical evaluation that helps to further explain why the term emotion was only scientifically and systematically studied after the mid-19th century, Dixon 2012, page 338, see also Dixon 2003. Solomon 2008 is cited in Scarantino and D'Souza 2021, page 6. The general outcome is that emotions are conceptualized in two different ways. First, sometimes emotions appear as something overwhelming to the subjects who experience them, in the face of which only rationality can guarantee justice. And second, emotions appear as allies of justice and reason when the virtue of justice can become the sense of justice, its operations assured by benevolent social passions rather than by rationality, Rorty 1982, pages 159 to 160. Rorty points out that what makes emotions especially insightful, and able to provide a diagnosis for proposals of a conception of the mind, is that they are found in that no man's land where theories create the experiences they describe, and yet also in that area where there are constraints, Rorty 1982, page 171. Emotions are conceived as having a certain place in the topography of the mind, Scarantino and D'Souza 2021, pages 1-2, and accepted as part of the mind. According to Rorty's historical diagnosis, this means that when philosophers further analyze emotions, they identify that emotional processes interfere with the underlying description of the mind and consequently integrate them as part of the conditions of the functioning of the mind, Rorty 1982. According to Amelie Rorty, this theoretical consequence is still present in contemporary proposals for emotion theories, Rorty 1982, pages 171-172. That is, the contemporary philosophical work focuses on various roles of emotions in the functioning of the mind, and when one philosopher revives this or that aspect of their role in the mind and in life, focusing on this or that apparent theory and neutral facts, it appears that disputes between such theories are reproduced as disputes that can be straightened out by a little terminological hygiene, Rorty 1982, page 172. However, given that the problem lies deeper in the historical inheritance, and no complete genealogy can be offered, there are always other possibilities that complicate the theoretical suggestions given by how the philosophical history with its babble of conflicting tongues remains alive and intact within us, Rorty 1982, page 172, making communication among theorists of different philosophical schools virtually impossible. One important consequence of recognizing this historical picture is disclosing that empirical research is also based on philosophical commitments, which are adopted with various degrees of consciousness, from researchers in a variety of different research fields. Thus, there is another explanation for the well-recognized contemporary plurality of emotion theories, Brady 2019, D'Souza and Scarantino 2018, Griffiths and Scarantino 2009, suggesting that the emotional landscape of plural theoretical proposals may very well be not a shortcoming of our contemporary theories impossible to be overcome, but a diagnosis of the inadequate underlying theories of mind present in philosophy and all other fields of expertise that research on emotion. Though Brady identifies the culprit as the wide range of things that are covered by the term emotion, Brady 2019, page 13, the problem may be also brought about by the underlying philosophical heritage and its undiagnosed confusion. Biased examples of emotion. The second issue that reveals the richness of emotion research for further reflection concerns how the examples of emotion given by the different theories tendentiously format the reflection about emotions in general. As Brady well explains, the theoretical term emotion refers to an ample range of phenomena within the emotional landscape, Brady 2019, page 13. The term emotion includes at one extreme automatic bodily reaction as bodily disgust, some kinds of fear, anger, and surprise, and at the opposite extreme more complex emotions such as schadenfreude, compassion, remorse, and pride. There are two consequences of the inevitable choice of examples within this wide amplitude of meaning. First, the theoretical proposals select examples of emotions that reinforce their own project and privilege specific descriptions of emotion. Second, the wide amplitude of the term makes any attempt to fix a taxonomy of theories of emotion difficult to attain. Though the muddy terrain is ultimately given by the way these two consequences cannot be completely set apart, for the sake of clarity, they are considered separately. The last consequence pointed out is well exemplified by Brady's great effort to present a coherent historical perspective on emotion theories. After having described feeling theories and the cognitive ones, he shows how different versions of perceptual theories seem to collapse to one or the other type of theories of emotion previously described, Brady 2019, page 31. And the issue is not just due to how the analogy between emotional experience and perceptual experience is questionable, as Brady insightfully points out. The matter in question may hide a more complex problem about the very nature of offering an emotion theory with a set of selected examples of emotions, and using their interpretation to provide a complete understanding of the entire emotional landscape. In what concerns the first consequence, what is problematic is not that the theoretical proposals reinforce their own project by picking specific examples, but that, by doing so, they also fall prey to their own biased portrayal. Take, for example, the suggestion offered by William James to invert the order of the events for a better understanding of an emotional experience. He argues that it is not the perception of some object or event, i.e., a dangerous bear moving towards you, that excites the fear, but instead that the bodily changes that follow the perception of the object or event, and that these changes, as they occur, make up the emotion, Brady 2019, page 17. James offers specific examples to illustrate his proposal, writing that, "We lose our fortune, are sorry and weep, we meet a bear, are frightened and run, we are insulted by a rival, are angry and strike," James 1984, page 190, and inadvertently he implies that all instances of each emotion is dictated by the descriptions given. This suggests, for instance, that all cases of fear will somehow resemble the fear of a bear. Even though William James, 1884, carefully begins his famous article "What is an Emotion?" by stating that he will only consider emotions that have a distinct bodily expression, James 1884, page 189, it is still the case that the fear considered is that of the danger in the wild, and no consideration is made to how this emotional experience is different or not from other instances of fear, such as fear of bureaucracy, or fear of a damaged self-image, or of the futility of life. The theoretical outcome is that fear in general is that his account of fear overgeneralizes from the example of seeing a dangerous animal, and consequently asserts without any detailed discussion that all instances of fear must somehow resemble it. This uncritical way of using examples is reasonable enough, and only reveals its problematic silhouette when crucial links of emotions to other aspects of the mind are identified. The subtlety of the problem makes it difficult to spot its importance, which makes it all the more difficult to be overcome. As an illustration of the unsettling nature of the puzzle, take the description of pride in Chapter 4 of Brady's book, Emotions and Social Groups. Brady uses the example of pride to show how emotions have social value and that they communicate virtues that benefit groups. He starts by using Gabrielle Taylor's definition of pride, writing that, "We feel pride in some object or event that we think is valuable or desirable, and that stands in some relation of belonging to us," Brady 2019, page 110. Emphasizing how the definition clearly mirrors the evaluative nature of emotions, Brady further grounds and reinforces his proposal, calling upon recent work in social psychology to show that the empirical testimony indicates how facial and bodily expressions of the emotion of pride have the function of advertising and communicating one's achievements to others, and as a result of enhancing one's status and esteem, Brady 2019, page 111. Brady continues by pointing out how individuals strive for socially valued achievements by appealing to how pride reveals, and simultaneously enhances, reputation and social status, which can also be recognized in how pride is pedagogically reinforced, Brady 2019, pages 111 to 112. Brady inadvertently takes for granted the connection of pride to the constitution of the self. The link between self and pride is fundamental to understanding the overall self-reflective nature of the emotion of pride. In fact, the analysis of pride in the philosophical literature appears in a decisive manner with David Hume, and is made a pivotal point for the construction of the fictional idea of the self as an agent, Rorty 1990, page 256. Hume underlines how the admiration and prize of the sources of pride by others introduces historicity and cultural variability on the idea of the self, Rorty 1990, page 262, and shows that the way pride affects agency is intimately connected to the ways in which some pleasures and pains are weighted by their central connection to her conception of herself, a conception that identifies her long-range interests, Rorty 1990, page 263. This is why Hume gives pride its place in his explanation of agency, and in so doing changed the meaning of pride, Rorty 1990, page 269. Pride was no longer merely a sin because the connection to agency opened the possibility of describing it as a crucial element for personal transformation. Ultimately, it could also explain why a person would attempt to change her motivational structure by changing her conception of what is essential to her, and changing her conception of herself by rearranging the pattern of what gives her pride. Rorty 1990, page 266. Even though Hume might have been skeptical of isolated moves of self-reform, Rorty 1990, page 266, the crucial element of Hume's work on pride is that it enables the pursuit of virtue by recognizing the variable and modifiable nature of the notion of self, while simultaneously revealing the connections between psychology and politics, Rorty 1990, page 269. According to the description given by Amélie Rorty, pain and suffering are an unfortunate consequence of the transformative character of pride, and not a necessary condition because the inevitably relevant link is given to pride's connection to agency and to the self. Of course, this implies that agency for self-transformation must often represent some level of endurance and effort. Nevertheless, Brady's discussion of pride would have been greatly enhanced by identifying this historical connection, and he would have been able to refer to various elaborations of Hume's proposal, which are available in the more recent literature on philosophy of emotions, Davidson 1976, Bayer 1978, Rorty 1990. This would have provided a different density to the philosophical description of why feelings of pride are often central to specific social groups, Brady 2019, page 123, and would have revealed why pointing out certain connections has a philosophical sharpness that enhances the understanding of emotion both theoretically and in people's daily lives. In the reflection about pride, Brady makes a general link between pride and pain, arguing that, even though pride is generally of a positive valence, it entails overcoming pain and suffering. This is because people wouldn't value or pursue some goal or activity unless it involved pain and suffering, Brady 2019, page 113, and the consequences of these aspects of the experience of pride are a part of the condition of feeling it. This takes us to our third and last item of the commentary, emphasizing how the definition clearly mirrors the evaluative nature of emotions. Brady further grounds and reinforces his proposal, calling upon recent work in social psychology to show that the empirical testimony indicates how facial and bodily expressions of the emotion of pride have the function of advertising and communicating one's achievements to others, and as a result of enhancing one's status and esteem, Brady 2019, page 111. Brady continues by pointing out how individuals strive for socially valued achievements by appealing to how pride reveals, and simultaneously enhances, reputation and social status, which can also be recognized in how pride is pedagogically reinforced, Brady 2019, pages 111 to 112. Brady inadvertently takes for granted the connection of pride to the constitution of the self. The link between self and pride is fundamental to understanding the overall self-reflective nature of the emotion of pride. In fact, the analysis of pride in the philosophical literature appears in a decisive manner with David Hume, and is made a pivotal point for the construction of the fictional idea of the self as an agent, Rorty 1990, page 256. Hume underlines how the admiration and prize of the sources of pride by others introduces historicity and cultural variability on the idea of the self, Rorty 1990, page 262, and shows that the way pride affects agency is intimately connected to the ways in which some pleasures and pains are weighted by their central connection to her conception of herself, a conception that identifies her long-range interests, Rorty 1990, page 263. This is why Hume gives pride its place in his explanation of agency, and in so doing changed the meaning of pride, Rorty 1990, page 269. Pride was no longer merely a sin because the connection to agency opened the possibility of describing it as a crucial element for personal transformation. Ultimately, it could also explain why a person would attempt to change her motivational structure by changing her conception of what is essential to her, and changing her conception of herself by rearranging the pattern of what gives her pride. Rorty, 1990, page 266. Even though Hume might have been skeptical of isolated moves of self-reform, Rorty, 1990, page 266, the crucial element of Hume's work on pride is that it enables the pursuit of virtue by recognizing the variable and modifiable nature of the notion of self, while simultaneously revealing the connections between psychology and politics, Rorty, 1990, page 269. According to the description given by Amélie Rorty, pain and suffering are an unfortunate consequence of the transformative character of pride, and not a necessary condition because the inevitably relevant link is given to pride's connection to agency and to the self. Of course, this implies that agency for self-transformation must often represent some level of endurance and effort. Nevertheless, Brady's discussion of pride would have been greatly enhanced by identifying this historical connection, and he would have been able to refer to various elaborations of Hume's proposal, which are available in the more recent literature on philosophy of emotions, Davidson 1976, Bayer 1978, Rorty 1990. This would have provided a different density to the philosophical description of why feelings of pride are often central to specific social groups, Brady 2019, page 123, and would have revealed why pointing out certain connections has a philosophical sharpness that enhances the understanding of emotion both theoretically and in people's daily lives. In the reflection about pride, Brady makes a general link between pride and pain, arguing that, even though pride is generally of a positive valence, it entails overcoming pain and suffering. This is because people wouldn't value or pursue some goal or activity unless it involved pain and suffering, Brady 2019, page 113, and the consequences of these aspects of the experience of pride are a part of the condition of feeling it. This takes us to our third and last item of the commentary: pain and emotion. There is nothing contradictory in itself about Brady's interconnection between pride and pain, which is presented in Chapter 4. However, when the book is taken as a whole, one needs to discuss how the proposed link between pride and pain can be maintained in light of the description of pain from the previous chapter, which argues that pain is of critical importance for motivation for action because being in pain does, by itself, provide some motivation to act so as to alleviate that pain. Brady 2019, page 90. This offers ground for more reflection, as the two chapters appear to be in contradiction. In the third chapter, Brady presents pain as a feeling that cannot be termed an emotion, except metaphorically, Brady 2019, page 16, which is crucial for the understanding of emotion's motivation story. Brady argues that emotions move us in much the same way that pains move us, Brady 2019, page 89, because just as the way people are motivated to avoid and overcome pain, the unpleasantness of remorse persists, normally up to and until we behave appropriately and make adequate apologies and reparations, Brady 2019, page 96. Yet, this description of pain seems to go against the description of how people look for difficult and painful experiences to be proud of their achievements in the fourth chapter. This gives the overall book project a theoretical tension to be resolved. In addition, it raises further and more complicated questions. Is it the case that people look for certain types of pain because it can, in the long term, grant them the experience of pride? Are people making a point of making their pains transparent and public to be able to subsequently feel pride? Does this pedagogical reinforcement encourage mimicking pain for the process of learning to be more rewarding? What happens when their pain and effort is not recognized? The tensions and problems identified are best understood as a sign of the richness of pain for the enlightenment of emotion theory, given that the scientific study of pain, one of the most controversial areas in neuroscience, is rife with philosophical problems, Adidi and Guzzeldeer 2002, page 266. Consequently, many issues regarding the connection of emotion with pain are still in need of philosophical reflection. For example, there is no philosophical account of why the desensitization to our own or to other people's pain tends to lead to an overall blunting of emotional sensitivity, Koch 2014, page 222. And though the cognitive element of pain modifies the experience of pain, the sensation remains incorrigible, Oakes 1966, page 256, suggesting that the emotional richness of pain is what makes pain difficult to communicate, Shepherd Hughes 2019, page 32, and why some cases of emotional pain like self-pity are hard to capture by any philosophical emotion theory. There are many more thought-provoking topics, such as the way the book takes up again and again the need to rethink the relationship between reason and emotion, for as Bernard Williams writes, it would be a kind of insanity never to experience sentiments. And it would be an insane concept of rationality which insisted that a rational person never would. Williams, 1981, page 29. When Brady explains how emotions are important because they undermine or short-circuit our reasoning and reflection, Brady, 2019, page 2, he adds an unquestionable contribution to reinforce how emotion research gives rise to a reconceptualization of rationality, Mendonca and Sagua, 2019, page 122. I hope that my commentary has made the reader curious to read the book and contributed to enhancing how Brady shows that these issues are inevitably connected to questions such as, how do we do philosophy? How do philosophers think about the nature of emotion? How can philosophy help us to understand this part of our experience, and indeed anything at all? Brady, 2019, page 8.
Article 8. Replies to Benzev, Starkey, Reyes Cardenas, Bloomfield, La Guardia Lo Bianco, and Mendonca. By Michael Brady. Response to Aaron Benzev. Benzev identifies two main worries with my view in his generous and typically erudite and rigorous commentary. One of these is classificatory. The other concerns the role of emotions in morality. Both are important and raise very interesting points for me to think about and for further investigation on my part. And I am grateful to Benzev for encouraging me to do so. Components and theories. Benzev highlights worries with both my identification of the components of emotion and the categorization of theories of emotion. He's right to do so. With respect to the former, I agree that more things might be explicitly included here, such as memory and imagination, and also that some of the categories appear to overlap. In response, I think that in a much more developed account, I would explain the kind of perception involved, the non-evaluative perception of an object or event, such as the smell of the contaminated meat, and also that the thinking component can, and perhaps always does, include memory and imagination. So there is room for the elements that Benzev thinks are essential in my classificatory scheme. One of the valuable things about this kind of classification into different components, however we do it, is to show the complexity of emotion, and that is one of the main things that I was wanting to do here, to illustrate that they are not brute impulses or reactions, but of structure, i.e. elements that are related in a particular way. This foreshadows some of the things that Starkey will say later about binding between elements. I guess that there is always an element of artificiality when it comes to such things, however, given the complications that Benzev rightly points out. Similarly, I happily accept Benzev's worries about dividing the theories of emotion as I do into feeling, cognitive, and perceptual theories. These overlap to a significant degree, as I point out in my book here, but go into greater detail in emotional insight. And so again, there is an element of artificiality when dividing things up in these ways. Benzev's own classificatory approach seems very helpful here. But note that here too, there is some overlap. Feeling theories can be a form of evaluative approach as, e.g., Jesse Prinz argues in his 2004 book, Gut Reactions, a perceptual theory of emotion. Feeling theories can also be perceptual theories, since the latter need not be merely cognitive, as Starkey points out below in his proposal for a new perceptual model. So it isn't clear that there is a neat division into four distinct theories, at least on Benzev's identification of the four modes of reference. Benzev's worries here about how to identify components and about how to classify theoretical approaches raise a number of very interesting questions about what is really at stake when we use these terms and engage in philosophical theorizing about emotion. Suppose that we agree with Benzev that all four elements are present in emotional experience. Do we think that any element has priority here? Indeed, what does the claim about priority here mean? Might this depend upon disciplinary interests, so that moral philosophers are more interested in the evaluative elements of emotion, while psychologists and neuroscientists about the affective elements? So Benzev's critical comments generate very interesting questions about what we are doing when we theorize about emotion, especially if we are roughly in agreement about the kinds of elements that emotions typically involve and the importance of each in emotional experience. I want to thank him for making me think some more about these issues and questions. Emotion and morality. Like Bloomfield below, Benzeyev questions whether knowledge of moral value is merely emotional and whether we can rely on emotions themselves to know. Like Bloomfield and Benzeyev, I think not, and it is instructive to consider why. Part of my view here, which I discuss in response to Bloomfield, is rather more skeptical about the epistemic value and outputs of emotional experiences themselves. For we might well doubt that emotions themselves give us knowledge, or even genuine justificatory reasons when it comes to evaluative belief or judgment. Nevertheless, emotions are important as sources of evaluations, understood as appraisals of our evaluative landscape, and as sources of motivation for us to seek out reasons that bear on their accuracy. As a result, emotions help to promote and facilitate, at least when under the control of virtuous habits of attention, evaluative understanding. I am very interested in reading and learning more about what Benzeyev says about emotional intuition, deliberative thinking, and intuitive reasoning, and about what it means to claim that the first two feed into the third. I agree that emotions are essential but not exclusive, and I want to think much more about this topic. Response to Charles Starkey. Starkey presents a rich, sophisticated, and very interesting response to the book, and I'm very grateful to him for this and his care and attention in looking at my views. His response aims to do two things. The first is to present a version of the perceptual model which doesn't succumb to my criticisms. The second is to highlight a range of ways that emotions are important for virtue in a way which complements my own account. Let's look at these in turn. A new perceptual model? Starkey's account proposes that emotional perception involves emotional binding between three elements. Affective arousal, specific cognitions about some object, including a complex understanding of the situation, and relational theme information about the relation of the situation to one's concerns, and which need not involve complex cognition. These are experienced as unified in emotional experience. An emotional binding mirrors the psychological binding that occurs in perception. For example, in an episode of anger while driving, physiological changes are associated with the driver of another car rather than with the air freshener hanging from one's rearview mirror. And the arousal and the cognition of the driver are also bound with the relational theme information of a demeaning offense, i.e., the core relational theme on which anger is based. I think that the notion of emotional binding is a very important one for the philosophy and psychology of emotion, and as Starkey points out, is well placed to capture the experiential association involved in emotional experience. It is one that I need to think more about. I wonder, though, whether Starkey's theory can indeed avoid the two difficulties I raise. Starkey argues, first, that this kind of perceptual model does not collapse into a feeling theory, since an informationally robust cognition is part of a normal emotional event, and nor does it collapse into a cognitive theory, since the affective element is bound up with the cognition of the object. Now, this looks like it won't collapse into the other theories by stipulation, and that's fine as far as it goes. What we might need is an argument that all three of the elements are always necessary for and bound together in emotional experience. But I wonder how Starkey might respond to the kind of earlier line pushed by Jesse Prinz, that it is the affective element that carries relational theme information. Is there any advantage of Starkey's account over a more parsimonious perceptual model? I'm less convinced by Starkey's attempt to avoid the second worry. He argues that emotions might be a kind of rationally accessible perception because they're not rigidly tied to a narrow set of stimuli, but are more flexible responses. For this reason, emotions are not domain-specific modules, but general evaluations that can be activated in a wide variety of contexts. As a result, he holds that they are more flexible and more prone to error than perceptions. This is an intriguing suggestion, but it might not be entirely convincing. Pain sensations are, notoriously, prone to error, capable of top-down influences and cognitive penetration, and are not rigidly tied to a narrow set of stimuli. The softest touch can be painful on an injured part of the body. Still, pains are not rationally accessible. In addition, I'm not sure that I agree that the difference between the rational assessment of emotions and perceptions is grounded in practical reasons. One response would be to say that we have the practice of holding people responsible for their emotions, but not their perceptions, because emotions are responsive to reasons, whereas perceptions are not. A second reason, and this is related to one of the things that Bloomfield says in his commentary below, is that there are many different ways in which we assess emotions normatively, only some of which are related to their practical and social importance. It might be socially vital to respond with fury when insulted in some historical cultures, and yet this doesn't speak to the fact that fury would not be a fitting response to a minor insult. So I think that it is unlikely we can explain the range of normative assessment of emotion just on practical lines. Emotion and virtue. Starkey discusses a range of important ways in which emotions can make a positive contribution to our virtuous traits and can be operative in virtue, apart from their effects on motivation. There are fascinating and important points raised here, and I agree with much of what he has to say about the specific ways in which emotions affect perception and influence character traits. By influencing how we attend to important objects and events, by affecting how we see ambiguous figures, by increasing processing of the object of the emotion, by affecting the import an object has for a subject, and by conveying the significance of action possibilities. As he rightly points out, this has implications for character traits because collectively emotions significantly alter our perception of our environment as we move through the world. However, I particularly want to focus on Starkey's claim that, on a fundamental level, emotions underlie the persistence of character traits by preventing axiological entropy, the diminishment over time of the sense of the importance of values on which character traits are based. Without emotions, the significance of values related to those emotions would fade and the character traits that involve those values would diminish. There is something that is obviously right about this. To take a timely example, emotional engagement at conferences reminds us of the value of philosophical discussion and community. The importance of such things might diminish when we spend most of our time working alone in our offices or recuse ourselves from teaching because of administrative roles and so on. Emotions can also highlight how much things mean to us, which becomes apparent when certain values are under threat. To take a small-scale example of environmental values, when the developers propose building on a nearby green site, feelings of concern for that site bring home to us how valuable that site is. However, one question here for Starkey and others concerns how compatible all of this is with the idea that emotions themselves suffer entropy without any apparent diminishment of value. I thus wonder about the scope of Starkey's claims here. For example, think of how depth of love usually co-occurs with the diminishment of emotions of passion. Here it does not seem true that the value of one's beloved diminishes without passionate emotions. Often it is the opposite. And there is such a thing as compassion fatigue for those, e.g., in the medical profession. But here too we might think that feelings of compassion often fade with experience, with no loss of, indeed, often with an increased depth of appreciation of the relevant value. Ditto for high court judges and the value of justice, art critics and the value of artworks, and so on. As a result, I think that the interplay between different forms of the appreciation of value and the waxing and waning of emotion is probably very complex and at least a two-way process. It is certainly a topic that merits a lot of thoughtful discussion, and yet another point I hope to devote more time to, thanks to Starkey's comments. Response to Panuel Reyes Cardenas. I'd like to offer my thanks to Reyes Cardenas for the extremely kind and generous words, and especially about how enjoyable he found the experience of reading the book. One of the points raised by Reyes Cardenas is that I could have a more substantial connection to a longer historical tradition. I think that this is both true and a welcome charge. The book could indeed be better informed by history, and the lack of engagement here is a fault of much contemporary philosophy. I often feel embarrassed by the degree to which my writing fails to pay attention to the history of the subject and the history of thinking about emotion in particular. I try to rectify this a little in Suffering and Virtue, but not enough. Reyes Cardenas is right again to highlight an omission, when it comes to the role of emotions in self-knowledge. This, as he writes, is the important place of emotions in the knowledge of the convergence of emotions and thought in our intellectual lives, and the need of this to achieve a positive grasp of the meaning of our own selves. As it happens, I think that negative emotions, and especially forms of suffering, often play a central role in enabling us to find meaning in our lives. This seems especially true when we consider negative emotions that occur in illness or at the end of life. The book would have benefited from a deeper discussion about this and about the inward turn to knowledge and understanding of oneself that Reyes Cardenas emphasizes. Likewise, Reyes Cardenas is right to think that more attention could have been paid to the role of emotions in the formation of a moral conscience and how vital this is in our lives. I might do well to consider, should there be a second edition of the book, where an account of emotion and conscience would fit in the account of moral development that I do give. So Reyes Cardenas's remarks here will stimulate me to do some reading on this historical tradition and deepen my understanding here. Equally, his remarks on William James and the epistemic role that passions and affections have are food for considerably more thought on a Jamesian model than I have given the topic thus far. Perhaps Reyes Cardenas's greatest worry concerns a lack of clarity in my discussions of the role that emotion has in metaethics, and the danger that what I say here, or don't say clearly enough, might support dichotomous thinking about emotion and reason, rather than, as I've tried to do throughout the book, undermine such thinking. I suspect the worry here is that in dismissing emotivist/sentimentalist approaches, I buy into the view of emotion that such approaches embody, and that this is a view in which emotion is opposed to reason. I guess even Hume doesn't think this is the case, only that moral distinctions are not grounded in reason, but in passion or desire. This raises the possibility, to which I think Reyes Cardenas might be sympathetic, that more sophisticated versions of expressivism might acknowledge the central role that emotion plays in our rational lives. Consider the sophisticated rational sentimentalist accounts developed by Justin Darmes and Daniel Jacobson, for one prominent example. But I'm happy to accept that my relatively quick move through metaethical possibilities might well cause worries of this sort. Again, something I would hope to address in another edition of the book. Response to Paul Bloomfield. Bloomfield raises a host of very interesting points in his detailed, generous, and subtle response. At the same time, he puts pressure on various aspects of my positive account of the value of emotion with respect to our knowing, our acting, and our virtue. He has my gratitude for all of this. I think he is exactly right on some points about the functional role of emotion in blocking thought, for instance, and I have a lot of sympathy with his more general criticisms, viz., that the book is too focused on a positive picture of what emotions do, that I don't focus enough on the normativity of emotion. But as I'll explain, I'm not sure we differ too much on some central issues about the epistemic and motivational benefits that emotion can bring. In what follows, I want to address some of the central places where we differ and offer a number of tentative responses. Emotions we'd be better off without. Bloomfield rightly points out that there are many negative emotions that I don't discuss, and that we would be better off without. Ugly emotions which all humans would always be better off without. Apathy, hopelessness, despair, dread, loneliness, bitterness, spite, greed, jealousy, covetousness, vindictiveness, vengefulness, arrogance, condescension, hubris, wrath, malice, and the granddaddy of all negative emotions. Hate. Now later on, when discussing LaGuardia Lobianco's comments, and the notion of emotion and virtue in non-ideal circumstances, we'll encounter some emotional responses that might typically be seen as bad and as non-conducive to flourishing, and yet which might be virtuous in some circumstances. Hypervigilance, hubris, anger, cynicism, distrustfulness can all serve us extremely well when, e.g., we are oppressed or suffering from illness and have to cope. And it is possible at least that arrogance and bitterness might be amongst these. So one option here is to say that we can always identify non-ideal circumstances in which some humans wouldn't be worse off as a result of these. But a second point is to highlight the fact that many slash all of these are chronic or malfunctioning types of genuinely helpful and valuable emotions. Think of dread as an extension of fear when things are truly dreadful. What is true is that all humans would be better off without having to face truly dreadful things, without this implying that there is something wrong intrinsically with feeling dread. And wouldn't this be fitting when things are truly dreadful? Similarly with lonesomeness. It can be utterly miserable to be without someone, and lonesomeness brings this home to us. But it's not clear that it is lonesomeness that is something we would be better off without, as opposed to the situation in which we are alone. Clearly, we'd be better off without that being so. In any case, isn't it the price that we have to pay as a part of a suite of relevant responses for having attachments in the first place? By the same token, arrogance stems from a surfeit of pride and is to this extent problematic. But it might be the price that we pay for having the capacity for pride. So I'm not entirely sure that these cases of negative emotions identify particular distinct emotion types that we would be better off without. Emotions are much less helpful and reliable than I suggest. Bloomfield is certainly right to highlight the many ways in which we can be too emotional to the detriment of our believing and acting. He writes, "Emotions and passions, strong and uncontrolled as they are, typically distort perception and judgment and only rarely lead to a deep, veridic, and insightful understanding of the world." He is also right that it is rare that the virtuous person relies on emotions alone in their judging and acting, and that reliable emotional reactions, suitable for providing epistemic and moral justification, are more rare than it is typically assumed. But I'm not sure that we disagree on any really substantial issue here. For I also think that emotions alone do not suffice for justification. Indeed, I have argued that emotions by themselves do not constitute sufficient reasons or sufficient evidence for evaluated belief, and so can't suffice to justify. In typical cases, we seek out reasons and considerations that bear on the evaluative situation that emotion presents to us. It's only when we can't seek out the reasons and considerations, when we have nothing else to go on, that we put our trust only in our emotion, this being better than nothing. What I disagree with Bloomfield about, I suspect, is the extent to which emotions are epistemically helpful, if not sufficient, for our believing and acting. And here I genuinely do want to be positive. For think of how inquiry, believing, or acting would go if people were non-emotional. Thomas Reed makes the point nicely. We need some degree of curiosity, or emotion more broadly, to fix attention and come to consider judgment. Similarly, with the motivational story, feelings of compassion are surely central to genuinely compassionate behavior, and indeed motivate such behavior, even though we need reason and reflection to tell us what the behavior is to determine the right kind of response to the circumstances. So I agree that emotion is not sufficient for the justification of action and belief, but it is often at the heart of the story that we do tell. Is curiosity an emotion? I certainly think that it has certain features that are characteristic of an emotion in terms of components. It also comes in episodic, state, and trait forms. I might, for instance, be intensely curious about the note she passed to him, or curious for some time about who committed the crime. Or it could be true of me that I'm a curious person. Now Bloomfield thinks curiosity is an intellectual desire, like lust is a carnal desire. I guess this depends on how much we think a particular kind of evaluation of the interesting, the curious, is bound up with curiosity. I think, and psychologists like Paul Sylvia, 2006, agree, that curiosity has a certain kind of appraisal structure that seems missing from mere intellectual desire, i.e., an urge to find out for the sake of finding out. That kind of desire seems itself too coarse-grained, too indiscriminate. So the need to respect the evaluative structure of curiosity suggests to me that it is an emotion. Can emotions tell us about value? Bloomfield also questions any quick move from the claim that emotions give us information about what we value to information about what is valuable. The former does not involve any implication of objective or stance-independent value, of course, since, as he rightly points out, You might find someone charming, and I might find them annoying, and for exactly the same features. Now, one quick response is that in some cases, the distance between what we value and what is valuable is rather modest or small. The charming might be one example. The amusing might be another. Likewise, there might well be values that depend upon our relations and yet seem objective. Cases of agent relative value might be like this. And once again, I don't think I'm committed to the view that emotions by themselves tell us about what is objectively valuable, at least in the sense of giving us an understanding of our evaluative landscape. For that, we need access to the reasons that are in play. And as noted, emotions are often very important in motivating the search for such reasons. A more positive claim is that emotions raise the question of what is valuable for us and also confirm our evaluative stances. Think of how fragile our evaluative view might be without emotional support, something that Thomas Reed also emphasizes. So without emotion, we might not have access to the possibility of something's being valuable. And without emotion, we might not have a safe and secure judgment that something is valuable. Even if emotions don't suffice for evaluative knowledge, they're nevertheless very important for it. What role do emotions play for the virtuous? Bloomfield argues that virtuous people are guided by virtues rather than emotions. The virtuous have trained themselves to be virtuously motivated and are guided by emotion only if they have no better decision procedure. Indeed, he suggests that emotions complete virtuous thought rather than guide it. Now, I think that part of the training that the virtuous undergo is training of emotion, to be emotionally moved in the right kind of way. Perhaps the emotions of such trained people then are background, ready to kick in should something go awry. Think of the fear experienced by a novice versus an experienced driver. I also think that feelings of love and compassion are genuinely motivational in the virtuous person, rather than merely completist, such that they act with and out of feeling. This raises a worry with Bloomfield's view that emotions complete rather than guide virtuous behavior. If we think that certain forms of virtuous behavior express emotion, compassion again seems prominent here, but also think of forms of love. So I think that emotions play more of a role in virtuous behavior than Bloomfield does. Still, the fact that each one of these points is important and merits a lot of further discussion, added to the fact that nothing I say here will do much to settle any disputes between us, are evidence of the depth and quality of Bloomfield's responses. I am very grateful to him for them and look forward to discussing these and other issues with him on future occasions. Response to Alicia LaGuardia-Lobianco. LaGuardia-Lobianco writes that my analysis assumes a certain sort of life, that which is shaped by the usual upsets and successes, griefs and loves, a certain sort of world, that which is safe, trustworthy, and ready to reveal its information, and a certain sort of agent, one who is oriented to this world as an eager discoverer and willing social participant. But in so doing, my account circumscribes the theory to ideal agents and circumstances. This is worrisome if we think the philosophy of emotions, perhaps more so than some other subfields of philosophy, should capture and explain human experiences as they are actually lived. An important, unfortunate aspect of lives as they are actually lived is that they commonly involve non-ideal conditions. To make this point, LaGuardia-Lobianco focuses on traumatic experiences and their fallout. What LaGuardia-Lobianco does in her fascinating response is to look at how trauma complicates, challenges, and expands my account of the value of emotion. This is interesting and impressive philosophy, and I'm very grateful to LaGuardia-Lobianco for her care and consideration in her comments. Now I agree with LaGuardia-Lobianco that the focus is primarily on the positive, and here her views line up nicely with Bloomfield's. But while Bloomfield is skeptical about the reliability of emotion and the extent to which it is typically helpful for believing, acting, and virtue, LaGuardia-Lobianco's point is that my book has too narrow a focus, and what we need is to consider how emotions function in a broader range of circumstances. As it happens, this worry mirrors something that Ian James Kidd has raised about my recent book Suffering and Virtue in a paper titled Suffering, Vulnerability, and Vices, MS, in which he takes me to task, in a nice way, because I focus too much on what suffering can do in the promotion of virtue and not what it can do and actually does in the promotion of vice. And like La Guardia Lo Bianco, Kidd considers the possibility that appropriate responses in non-ideal circumstances, responses we have a good pragmatic reason to have, are not responses that would promote our flourishing and look rather far from virtues. I think that La Guardia Lo Bianco is right to highlight the fact that emotions which have significant value in relatively ideal circumstances, curiosity, pride, humility, and the general emotional tendency to motivate the search for reasons, can be disastrous for those in abusive relationships or in conditions of political and other forms of oppression. So emotions that can help to bring about epistemic, motivational, and social goods, and which can facilitate the development of intellectual virtue, can lead to significant disvalue in non-ideal circumstances, and when they are functioning as they typically do. What the traumatized person needs to rely on, in many instances, are the kinds of traits that either come at a significant cost or run counter to the flourishing of the person. They need, in other words, what Lisa Tessman calls burden virtues. Interestingly, I think that the account of emotion and virtue I favor can accommodate these points in a way that suggests that my account need not be as oriented to the ideal as La Guardia Lo Bianco proposes. To see this, I might emphasize the fact, and more so than I did in the book, that emotions can play their positive roles and hence contribute towards other goods only under certain conditions. But when they do, they might be viewed as forms of or akin to faculty virtues. The notion of a faculty virtue was introduced into the philosophical lexicon by Ornis Sosa, 1991. On his view, a faculty is defined as the ability or power to attain certain accomplishments. He writes, "Now, of course, an accomplishment attainable in given circumstances may be unattainable in other circumstances. Therefore, abilities correlate with accomplishments only relative to circumstances. There is, for example, our ability to tell directly the color and shape of a surface, so long as it is facing middle-sized, not too far, unscreened, and in enough light, and so long as one looks at it while sober," and so on. Sosa, 1991, page 235. What kinds of things can we identify as faculties or abilities in this sense? Sosa notes that the most general faculties traditionally recognized are perception, introspection, and memory. Sosa, 1991, page 225. John Greco's, 1993, page 520. Examples are sight, hearing, introspection, memory, deduction, and induction. Now for Sosa, a faculty will be virtuous in light of its performance of powers. Sosa, 1991, page 227. It must demonstrate the ability to attain the set of accomplishments, i.e., to do the things it does to a high degree. And what this means for Sosa is that it outperforms feasible competitors in its delivery of the relevant goals or ends that constitute the accomplishments. Sosa, 1991, page 227. In Suffering and Virtue and Emotion. The basics, I expand the class of faculty virtues to include pain and nociception, and systems governing hunger, thirst, and sleep. But I also argue there that remorse can be a faculty virtue, just as pain is. And I'm inclined to think that curiosity can be as well, since it enables us to reliably achieve certain epistemic goods and goals in the right circumstances. One possibility is to bring the kinds of emotional responses that La Guardia Lo Bianco highlights as important for enabling survival in non-ideal conditions. Hypervigilance, closed-mindedness, mistrust, self-doubt, intellectual hubris, under the banner of faculty virtues. That is, we might think that emotional responses that we would typically regard as antithetical to flourishing or that we think are vicious count as faculty virtues in non-ideal circumstances, and so bring the kind of line that I propose and that La Guardia Lo Bianco supports closer together. There is certainly precedent for such a move, both in the views of Lisa Tessman and in the work of Ian Kidd and Javi Carrell, and which I endorse in Suffering and Virtue. Both Kidd and Carrell highlight certain emotions and traits as having significant pragmatic importance and value as a response to a different kind of trauma that related to serious physical illness. These include anger, bitterness, cynicism, defensiveness, distrustfulness, evasiveness, and rudeness. Red, for instance, Kids 2012, Paper Can Illness Be Edifying? And Carell's 2019 book Illness. These need not simply be viewed as merely useful emotions in the circumstances. Instead, it might well be the case that these can be the motivational components of genuine faculty virtues, given that they constitute abilities to attain certain accomplishments, survival, maintaining esteem, to protect us against pathophobic attitudes, and do so more efficiently than feasible competitors. Since I am happy to expand the range of virtues to include the dispositions associated with pain, hunger, thirst, and the feelings involved in these, and in remorse, then I'm inclined to accept that such responses can be faculty virtues, and so to deny Bloomfield's point that everyone will always be better off without these emotions and dispositions. If so, then this expansion will bring my views closer to those championed by La Guardia Lobianco, which, given the importance of her arguments, is from my perspective a very good thing. Response to Dina Mendonça. In the final commentary, Mendonça raises a number of interesting issues that my book generates. These are, in turn, 1. The issue of the relation between theories of emotion, empirical work, and theories of mind. 2. The relation between pride and self-constitution. And 3. The relation between pride and pain. On the first issue, I share Mendonça's skepticism as to whether empirical work by itself can prove decisive in settling major philosophical disagreements and disputes, not least because one needs philosophical reflection to assess the adequacy of the concepts being deployed in such work, and such reflection is often itself open to further debate. Think, for instance, of the difficulties encountered if we try to get a handle on what it means to like something or want something, or to be motivated to get something, to take just 3 that are prominent in areas of psychological research focusing on hedonics. Is it obvious that psychologists have an adequate conception on these terms or an understanding that would satisfy philosophers who work on the nature of desire or in action theory? Nevertheless, it seems clear to me that empirical work has a clear bearing on the directions in which philosophical thinking and progress can go. Witness, for instance, the importance of the phenomenon of pain asymbolia for philosophical questions about what pain is. Prior to empirical discoveries about asymbolia, it was a philosophical given, or a platitude, that pains are necessarily painful. Asymbolia cast doubt upon this idea, and in a way that has led to philosophical progress. Or so, at least it seems to me. I am not entirely convinced, however, by Mendonça's suggestion, inspired by Amélie Rorty, that different theories of emotion seem to reflect different theories or pictures of mind. Although clearly, developments in philosophy of mind can have a bearing on our theorizing about emotions. But there is not enough space here to delve deeper into this particular issue, fascinating though it is. On the second issue, Mendonça is right to suggest that a deeper understanding of pride and its importance would have emerged if I had looked at the literature that she cites, which elaborates Hume's proposal. The same is true of many other writings and traditions on pride, contemporary and historical. However, in addition to limits of space when writing a book of this kind, there are limits imposed by the point I was trying to make by looking at pride, which was to provide an illustration of the communicative value that expressions of pride can have. There is, of course, much more that pride can do. By the same token, I could have illustrated emotions' communicative value by looking at other emotions as well. Given that many emotions have recognizable facial expressions, and that these can, in certain circumstances, serve important group needs. So depth and detail and explanation when writing about pride here was limited by at least 2 factors. In a longer work, I would hope to be able to do pride justice, in part by tackling some of the ideas and traditions that Mendonça cites. On the third issue, Mendonça thinks that there might be some tension between my account of pride, the thought that sometimes we intentionally engage in activities which are painful because this enables us to communicate our virtue to others, and the claim that pain provides a model for how feelings motivate us. On that latter account, presented in Chapter 3, I argue that unpleasant feelings have an important motivational force, and this is true for both negative emotions and pains. It is important that they have such force in helping us to do what we usually have good reason to do. Mendoza thinks that this runs counter to the idea that people are sometimes moved intentionally to do difficult and arduous things. I think that Mendoza is right to note a potential tension here, but I think that it is one that we can overcome by paying attention to the motivational force that pains can have the first order, so to speak, and the higher order attractions that we can have towards pains. This phenomenon of ambivalence is familiar from other experiences. When we are scared and tempted to not go on a roller coaster, but strongly desire both this ambivalent feeling and the thrill of being on a roller coaster. Here we both desire not to take the ride and also want, at a higher level, the experience of excitement and thrill that is partly consequent upon the fear that we feel. So too with pain, which provides some motivation to stop whatever it is that we are doing, but which can also be desired from a higher level, and where the object of the desire is an experience that has pain at its heart. To illustrate, think of the common experience of wanting to eat food that is so spicy that it hurts. The pain of the spicy food provides some motivation to stop eating, but the pleasure we get from the endorphin rush from experiencing something which is painful motivates us to keep on eating. So I think that there is tension here, but no worrying conflict or contradiction. There are a lot of other interesting points that Mendoza raises and which merit a longer and more detailed response. But I am grateful to her for her comments and for the opportunity to address those that I could in this space.
This marks the end of the 2021, Volume 3, Issue 1, Summer Podcast Edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion. Please join us again for our next podcast edition of the Journal of Philosophy of Emotion.